Well, we might get this session underway. There may be some more people coming, but we don't want to waste our valuable time. So welcome, everyone, to this session on microinsurance pricing. It's very exciting to actually be part of a session where original research is being released for the first time. Most of the concurrent sessions about existing material, existing ideas, but this is a rare treat where we actually have the first type of research on pricing for microinsurance. So you should feel privileged to be here for the first airing of our guest speaker's material. Many of you may be wondering about the paper, because I'm sure you're all keen to study it ahead of time, and it's still in the process of production. It's being edited for formal submission, so this is why this really is the first opportunity to hear some of this new material. We will be leaving plenty of time for questions, but I warn you in advance that our guest speaker is very keen to hear from you, because, as I'll introduce him in a moment, he comes from an academic background, so he's keen to hear some very practical ideas from you. So I'm warning you ahead of time that when it comes to question time, we're also after advice from you as well, given we've got many learned and intelligent people in the audience. So without any further ado, let me introduce Saatchi Perkel. Saatchi is an academic actuary working at Macquarie University. He's been working on microinsurance since 2009. In 2011, he worked at the University of the Philippines in Diliman for a three-month period where he collected data and worked with Filipino colleagues who were interested in microinsurance. His research on microinsurance in 2013 was funded by an Actuaries Institute research grant, and that has supported the completion or near completion of two research papers. Please welcome Saatchi.
Thanks, Martin. Thanks for those very kind words. Still quite haven't mastered the smartphone. I leave it to my children to tell me how to operate that. Okay, so this is joint work with Thomas Engelmann, who's currently in Germany. He works for Goldman Sachs in Frankfurt at the moment, and two colleagues from the Philippines, Mia Pang Ray and Ivy Swan. So they're both lecturers in the College of Business Administration at the University of the Philippines in Diliman, and they've got a long-standing interest in microinsurance. And as Martin said, I went to the Philippines in 2011 to actually work in this area. Okay, the other person, Barbara Zeitz, that's a typo, that's for the other paper that I'm doing on microinsurance, so she didn't actually work on this, so sorry about that. Okay, so for those of you who don't know, let me just introduce what microinsurance is. So we've got microinsurance, it's basically insurance for the poor, okay, that's what it is. Aimed at people with low income, subject to generally accepted insurance principles. So what we're trying to do is we're trying to give individuals some sort of level of protection. Protection against risks, be it risk of death, health risks, risks to property, all those sorts of things. So that sort of traditional insurance needs, facilitating those traditional insurance needs, but aimed at the poor. So, of course, then straight away you have a challenge. You know, how do these people pay the premiums? You know, how do these people understand the products? Okay, so you can see that this is a type of insurance that is aimed at a very different market and requires a whole different way of thinking. All right, so these markets are actually developing, but there are challenges. And, I mean, the two things that are important for microinsurance are, one, is outreach. Okay, so, I mean, if this is such a good idea, if it's going to help people, if it's going to protect people against losses and risks that they face, okay, then it's important that people actually buy this stuff. Okay? We want people to purchase it, to use it, and for them to realize its benefits. Okay, so this achieving widespread outreach is very important. And straight away, that means an important thing, and that is that it's cheap. Okay, so it has to be cheap. It has to be. People have to be willing to buy this. People who are poor have very low willingness to pay. They are very critical consumers, and they will assess your product very carefully before they decide to buy, if indeed at all they decide to buy. Okay, so you've got this issue of how do you actually produce a product that's cheap enough that people want to buy. Okay, the second one, of course, is financial sustainability. If we're going to introduce this product and we're going to let it run, well, ultimately, if it's going to be funded by the private sector, if private insurance companies are actually going to run this book of business, it's got to make money. It's got to make a profit. Okay, the profit could be small, but it still has to make money. Okay, it's not charity. Okay, so if you're going to run this product, it's going to be sustainable. If this is going to work for a long time, if this is a viable member of the financial services community, this particular type of product, then it has to be financially sustainable. Okay, so that's important. Now, currently, when you look at the microinsurance landscape, what you see is it's predominantly life microinsurance. And there's a simple reason for that, and that is because microfinance exists. Okay, so microfinance, that's people borrowing small amounts of loans. This is like Muhammad Yunus and the Grameen Bank and all that sort of thing. People with very low levels of income borrowing small amounts and repaying it over time. Now, it exists, microinsurance exists, mainly because there's a credit risk, credit life risk. Okay, those people may die, they may not repay their loan. So often that microfinance is bundled with the life insurance product. So, that's the main sort of, that's why there is a lot of life microinsurance. Okay, but what I'm going to be talking about today is a product that wasn't just a credit life wrapper, but was a standalone life insurance product. Okay, so that actually faced the additional challenges of marketing as well, marketing this product to the poor. All right, so, what are the products with the problems? What are the problems with microinsurance? And these are some of the ones that I've already alluded to. Okay, so, for a start, you've got high transactions costs. High transactions costs because what happens is you actually have to, if it's not a wrapper to a micro loan, or indeed if it is a wrapper to a micro loan, those micro loans have to be made. You have to go out into the field, you have to sell this stuff. So there are high transactions costs. And indeed, the whole way of marketing life insurance to the poor throws up its own particular set of challenges. Okay, one sort of solution that people have found is they've used affinity marketing. So looking at groups, say like a group that helps the poor, an NGO that helps the poor, a union that works with poor workers, okay, and they say, hey, we'll come in and we'll help you by offering an insurance product to your members. So in that way you can get around the problems and the costs of marketing. Okay, so that's the high transactions cost. That's one way of dealing with it. There are all sorts of different ways, but that seems to be one successful solution. Information asymmetries, well obviously, hey, it's life insurance, okay, you're offering life insurance. You guys know all about that. Limited willingness to pay, they're poor. Okay. High lapse rates, well, if they're poor, when things get tough, the tough get going, and they get going away from your life insurance product. Right, so you have high lapse rates. All sorts of things are going on. If people don't perceive the need for the product, they will not continue to support it. And this can also be related to their level of financial maturity, their level of financial knowledge. So what happens is they pay the premium once, and of course they don't die, and they think, why am I doing this? I was sort of marketed into this. Why do I keep doing this? So if there's a level of financial maturity that's not there, then they're not going to continue to support the product. So, it's hard to convince these people to keep buying the product. And, you get some great examples of a village, right? So the village has been buying microinsurance, okay, and then the premium income starts to fall, then someone dies in the village. And then the next year the premium income rises. Because, this is worthwhile. We saw someone die. We saw what it does. This is actually worthwhile. So when you get that practical experience, things can often work. Now, the last thing, and that's what I want to focus on, is what can actuaries bring to this? Okay, so this is about the pricing aspect. Okay, so inability to evaluate and price risk. So pricing this product is hard for all these sorts of reasons. Okay, and microinsurance pricing throws up all sorts of challenges. And that's particularly what this paper is about. So you've got lack of data. You've got a lack of actuarial expertise in this area. Okay. It's slowly improving over time. And, of course, you've got some population, a target population, that you don't really know a lot about. And there can be some populations in that group of people that have their own particular challenges that you have to deal with. Okay, so there's lots of uncertainty, and you guys know, if things are uncertain, the price goes up. Okay, and then, of course, no one buys it. All right, so what I want to do today is drill into pricing, and what I want to do is I want to give you an example. I want to go through an example of data that I collected, because what you find in this area is there isn't much in the public domain. People, insurance companies are out there, they're marketing the products, they're doing a great job, but there's not a lot that's available publicly. Okay, so as an academic, someone who works in a university, this is something that I can do. I can sort of go out and get stuff and bring it into the public domain and show everybody. Okay, so I'm here to share my toys. All right, so what we've got here is we've got an example of a particular insurance company that existed. It insured small farmers and fisher folk, and when I was in the Philippines, I actually got access to all their data. Okay, there was a tiny little room in the university, in one corner of the university, and in it, there were two people who sat there every day, and they ran this insurance company. Two people. Okay, one person did all the data work, a young woman. She didn't have a university education, but boy, could she use a database. Right, she was trained. There was essentially a Dutch NGO, Dutch partner, who was an insurance company. They trained her, and she could use that database. Fantastic. So the data was really good. I had really access to very, very good data. The product itself was providing individual insurance cover. So what happens was the farmers and fisher folk were members of an organization that supported their needs. Okay, and one of the benefits was that they could join this insurance scheme. So many of them did. Okay, so that's where the scheme is coming from. Primarily providing life insurance cover, there was a small amount of disability cover, and there was a small hospitalization benefit. Okay, so people could go to hospital for a few days, you'd get the trip paid for, and you'd be able to spend a few days in hospital, and that would be covered. Right, so that's essentially, in a nutshell, the scheme. This is what happened. All right, so scheme started in 2003, was rolled out, and, well, I got the data in September 2011, so that's when the data stops. Right? And it's an interesting story here. What you're seeing here is we're starting off, of course, with small numbers, they grow, and then they really decrease. Okay, so there's a marketing story here. When this started off, the scheme was actively marketed. So they paid agents to go out, climb. If you guys know the Philippines, it's an archipelago, there are islands. People have to go out to the islands, they have to climb over mountains, they have to go and see the villagers, and they have to convince them to sign up. So they had agents to do that. At the beginning, they had agents to do that, and you can see what happened. Business was good, right? For a variety of reasons, after a period of time, they decided that they didn't want agents anymore. They stopped paying the agents. The agency workforce disappeared. And you can see what happens, right? There's some politics going in here as well. Okay, it wasn't, things weren't, well, let's just say actively marketed, right? So you can see that the scheme was beginning to die, and it wound up not long after I left, I believe. Okay, so that's what's going on. You can see the new policies, great, declining. You can see the lapses. Okay, straight away you see one characteristic of microinsurance, and that is the high lapse rates. Okay, so important. High lapse rates, how do you deal with that? Right, so what I'm going to do is I'm going to take you through all this data. I'm going to let the insurance scheme tell its own story, and hopefully at the end of this, you guys can tell me what I should do. All right, so important. Did this insurance scheme make money? Bottom line is, sure did. Made bucket loads of money. Okay, so what happened was the consultant, when they initially priced it, right, they just said, well, I'll get the population mortality table, average age, I'll take it to be 42, okay, that'll be the premium, and that's it. Okay, they had a good marketing team. The marketing team went out and marketed it. And, you know, strangely enough, all these people, there wasn't that, I mean, there's sure there was adverse selection, and you'll see that in a moment, but, you know, there wasn't bucket loads of it. You know, people weren't really abusing this, okay? It was an insurance scheme, and it seemed to work quite well. It was reinsured, so people were covering the losses. So this was the Dutch partner was helping them, so they reinsured the losses. So if there were deaths, the reinsurance paid for those large cash outflows. Okay, this premium refund thing, okay, that's a byproduct of Filipino insurance law, which says that if you pay insurance premiums, you're entitled to a return of premiums after 3 years, a return of part of the premiums. Okay, so when you price this, you've got to build in the reserve to repay the premiums if people hold the policy for over 3 years. And of course, if they don't hold the premium if they don't pay for the product for 3 years, you make a nice profit. Okay, because you get all the money that you reserved for. Okay, so first question that these people asked me, they were really excited. I went to their small office and I was really excited because, hey, you guys are doing microinsurance. That's great. I'm really interested in this. And they said, hey, you're an actuary. We need some advice. We don't know whether we're making money. And I said, well, okay, that's a good question. That's an important question. I'm perturbed that you're asking me after how many years? All right, but that's great. I can help you answer that question. So give me your data. And they sort of scratched their heads and they said, oh, yeah, okay, we'll give you your data. So I got the data and I looked at, you know, whether they were actually making money. And of course, you know, they're making bucket loads of money because the premium is too high. All right. So, and then of course it's important to investigate the data. I mean, what is actually going on here? All right, so let's look at what happens. Okay, so what I did is got the data. Thomas, the guy who now works for Goldman Sachs in Frankfurt, he ran it through some computer programs, essentially doing the survival analysis, working out probabilities. Okay, so here you go. We looked at probabilities of death and disability. So this is the probability there of permanent and total disability. That's the probability of death. They're not really that scary. Okay, there's 95% confidence intervals around those values. Okay, so, I mean, you know, not that scary. Of course, within the first year, there's a bit of mortality happening, but after that, it's not too bad. And it's sort of what you'd expect. There's a bit of adverse selection happening there. This is the big story, though, in terms of lapses, right? If you look at the probability of lapse, right, okay, after 1 year, you can see these are falling. Okay, so essentially, if they pay the premium for 1 year, I mean, they're guaranteed cover for 1 year, and then afterwards, people, of course, will stop paying premiums, and you can see those lapse rates going through over time. Okay, so it's a bit of a scary story in terms of lapses. Hospitalization rates, these are the hospitalization rates for the small hospitalization benefit that the policy provided. It's not too bad. It certainly wasn't being abused. Okay, so we can then look at those probabilities. So here's the numbers associated with those graphs. Okay, so persisting membership. So these are the probabilities that, you know, if you start off, you'll be with the product in 1 year. If you had the product after 1 year, you'd still be there after 2 years and 2 years to 3 years. Okay, so, I mean, you can see that the lapse is an issue. Permanent disability, not a real problem. It had a permanent disability benefit, but not really being used. Death, it's not too bad at all, really. I mean, you can see there's probably a bit of adverse selection there in the first year, but after that, not too bad. Lapse, well, there's those scary lapse rates. Okay, and there's the hospitalization. That's the probability of entering hospital in that year, okay, in that year, and in that year. Okay, so again, there's really nothing scary there. Things were ticking along. The system was working reasonably well. With those rates, if I was to calculate the actuarially fair premium, okay, so I'm looking at actuarial equity here. Let's just focus on that for the time being. Okay, what would the premium be? And I'm not distinguishing between men and women. I'm not breaking it down. I'm just looking for the overall cohort that was insured. What would those costs be? So the estimated fair premium, so you can see the fair premium bigger in the first year and then tails right away in years one and two. Okay, so by duration, you're seeing, you know, if you get people, if they stay in the scheme, that adverse selection effect disappears and the rates aren't scary at all. Cost of the premium refund provision. Okay, now here you can see something scary here. So this is a byproduct of government regulation. Okay, so the Filipino government, the Insurance Act requires that you refund premiums. And you can see that that causes a problem. So, I mean, remember my two goals here. My two goals are outreach and sustainability. Okay? So in terms of outreach, this is a problem because this is making this more expensive, right? It's making it more expensive. I mean, it's arguable that maybe that's not so bad because people actually get something, but they only get something after 3 years, so most of them don't get anything at all. So that's an issue. Hospitalization benefit, okay, so that's not too bad, really. If I put a 95% confidence interval around the actuarially fair premium, right, that's what it would be in the first year, okay, that's what it would be in the second year, that's what it would be in the third year. This is what they were charging, right? This is what they were actually charging. Right, so they were charging a lot more, and particularly in years two and three. Right, okay. Okay, just to show you, to drill this home to you that this was too expensive, here, this is just a hypothesis test to see whether there's a significant difference between the premium that they were paying and the actual cost. Right? So really, in the first year, they got it right pretty much in terms of the premium they were charging. But for years two and three, people who were hanging around, who were continuing this product for 2-3 years or longer, you can see that there's highly significant differences at 1%. Right? So way, way too expensive for people who are continuing with this product. All right, so let's now look at, rather than the cohort as a whole, let's drill down to look at the individual components of that cohort. So what I'm doing here now is I'm looking at the difference between males and females. So I'm now trying to split it out to look at the experience of males and females. And you can see that male mortality is a lot higher than female mortality. Okay, that's not a surprise in the Philippines, because most of the time what happens is the woman stays at home with the children. She has many. It's the world's most Catholic country. It's the only country in the world left where divorce is illegal. Malta, because of the its membership of the EU, had to change its laws a couple of years ago. So now the Philippines is the only one left. Right, so the wife stays at home, looks after the kids. The husband goes out to work, and much of this work is dangerous, and yeah, so they've got higher death rates. So as you can see, lapse rates. Well, you can see the difference between male attitudes and female attitudes. Okay, male attitudes. Something hasn't happened within the first year. Forget it. Right? Okay. Okay. We'll give that the axe. Move on. Do something else. Okay. The ladies are much more patient, but after a certain point of time, they lose their patience, and you can see that the slope of that is much greater than the slope of that. So, I mean, they're leaving this product in droves by that stage. Okay, so again, you know, you can see what's important in terms of marketing and in terms of getting this thing to work. You have to address these sorts of issues. Okay, so that's lapse according to gender. If we look at the gender differences, there's obviously a significant difference between male and female probabilities of death, right? In years two and three, it doesn't really happen, and that's mainly because the confidence band on those observations is so broad. There's just so few deaths, okay? So you're not getting any significant difference at all there, okay? But clearly in the first year, it's an issue. Lapses reflects the pattern that you saw in the diagram a moment ago, and that is here, male lapses very high in the beginning, whereas towards the end, the female lapse rate is significantly higher than the male lapse rate. Okay, so I mean, that's the environment in which we work. Okay, now, that is the end of my slides, because what I did was, in this paper, there's lots of mathematics and sort of lots of data work, and I stripped all of that out, and I saved you that. So that, I suppose, then leaves us a lot of time for questions and discussion, and for that, I will turn over to Martin.
Sort of microphones and such. Yeah, so just remember that to use the microphone. Because it's recorded, if you could just mention your name, and whilst you are most welcome to ask Saatchi questions about the study, the data, the scheme, what he's very interested in from the experience and wisdom in the room, if you were going to market, design a product in that environment, how would you go about it? Remembering, as Saatchi neatly said, the purpose is, and we want widespread appeal. If our mission is outreach, we want it to be sustainable. But if you've got a situation where lapses are high, there's going to be some anti selection. The expense of distribution is an issue. What would you do in terms of designing a product in that environment? But other questions are most welcome. Who's first? Don't be shy. Thank you, Alan.
Alan Merton. This microphone's for someone taller than me. Thanks, Saatchi. I'll make a few comments. I've got a few questions as well, but they relate to some of my comments, I guess. And I've seen a little bit of microinsurance in Vietnam and done a bit of work in Indonesia on microinsurance, and all the problems here are the problems that I've seen. I guess one of the you didn't talk much about the costs themselves outside the scheme, and I'm very interested in the distribution costs. Yeah, what it actually costs to get the sales, and the view of profitability will be very different as a result of that, presumably. And that's one of the biggest issues, as you said, is getting outreach, because it's getting people to buy. The other thing is then dealing with the renewal problem. So let me talk about a few things. On the issue of lapses, the key is, as you said, how do you show value, but how do you actually create the transactional ability. One of my questions is, how were premiums actually meant to be paid and who was paying them? You also distinguish between males and females, and I'm interested that if the males are the ones working and earning income, why are females buying insurance? And perhaps thinking about household insurance rather than individual insurance, and that's one of the things that happens in different communities, because you're actually saying it doesn't actually matter whether it's the male or the female, it's actually protecting the family against the risk of the breadwinner having a problem. And if you look at experience in other developed markets, actually it might be that getting the females to feel that the insurance is important, but the husbands are the insured lives, and so you tap into that early, I want to keep the insurance that the females seem to indicate, but then somehow deal with it afterwards. But I would ask the question and say that a really important thing for managing lapses is making sure that premiums can easily be collected and paid, and there's some process around doing that, because you know, they're not sending renewal statements and having an agent follow up and chase the money. If you go back to the old days of industrial insurance, that's why people kept paying the money, because somebody came and collected it, the old collector model. And that is something that's being used in microinsurance. So that's one on that. Selection and rates of claim, and this happens maybe a little bit more in different communities, say in Muslim communities where the concept of takaful and sharia and community sharing exists. Peer pressure, so peer pressure to retain the policy, to retain the insurance, and also to not make inappropriate claims, not to abuse the claims, and sometimes that might be about underwriting as well and adverse selection. You know, there are banks that have fantastic credit experience, unbelievably low default on loans, micro loans, because of community pressure, not because they price them well or they underwrite credit risk well. They don't do any of that. It's actually the community pressure, and I suspect that, well, I've seen that that comes into microinsurance as well. If you can try and use a community to manage the claims experience somehow for the members and get a sharing principle into it, that everybody's sharing in it, and perhaps profit share could be one of the things to do, then you're getting people making sure that everybody's working together so that the sick guys aren't coming for insurance when everybody else knows that they're sick. So that's a few starting off comments. I guess some of my questions would be, what happened with selling? How were premiums being paid? It looks like you measured yearly lapse experience. I'm interested that I'm surprised if people were paying up front a year's premium. Okay, so then actually you probably need to look at monthly lapse experience rather than yearly lapse experience, and whether, you know, they actually lapsed at the end of the first month, not the end of the first year. And my guess is that possibly happened, which would indicate a premium payment problem. Rather than I don't want the insurance. It's nobody came to collect the premium. I didn't know how to pay. So there's a couple of my questions at the end. Great. Really interesting, because the struggle with trying to work out this stuff I've had exactly.
All right. So let me answer some of those questions. Because the first one was a very important one, and that was costs. And I should have said that up front. But I just you know, sometimes these things totally disappear from your head. But it's a disclaimer. Okay, so remember, I went to this little room in the university, and there were these two people, and they were running this scheme. Okay, so, you know, they said, we want to know whether we're making money. And I said, sure, I'll try and help you. You've got to give me all your data. Okay, that was the first thing I said. The second thing I said is, you've got to give me your accounts. Right? So they gave me the accounts. Now, I've never done an accounting course in my life, but I have taught it for quite a few years. Yes, we won't go there. But I couldn't make heads or tails of the accounts. So what I had to do, I can't say anything about costs. I just can't say anything about. I just had to throw all that away.
Rather than looking at the accounts, sorry, Alan Merton again. A simple way to try and dig a little bit would be to say, well, what did agents get paid and on what basis? So yeah, you've got a theoretical, what was the compensation, and then work backwards from how much was sold and how much premium. And yes, the biggest issue, you never get clarity of this stuff, but that would at least give an indication. I'm sort of interested in whether they got, you know, 20% of the premium, or whether they got X pesos per sale, and whether there was any motivation to collect subsequent premiums, whether it depended on whether they maintained their policy for 1 year or 2 years. So the principles of rewarding people for selling, then also looking at cost of that.
Okay, that's a great point. Thanks for that, Alan. From memory, I think I tried to do that, but again, it was just... So, the weird thing was, I asked these people, you know, how much money does this scheme have? And they said, oh, we hold these bonds, government bonds. And I said, okay, so where's all the other money? Well, usually it's in the village. And I said, what do you mean? Well, typically the premium was collected in the village, usually by the village head person. And my understanding is the money stayed there. I tried to sort of figure out what was going on, but, you know, I could only push so far, and I didn't want to get myself into trouble or get these people into trouble. But black hole. Not sure. Probably corruption. But, yeah.
I don't want to dominate it. If anyone's interested, I can show you some photos on my BlackBerry. The banking equivalent of managing this is... Yes, it doesn't quite stay in the village, but I've sat in on sessions where the bank's representative is a member of the community. They meet in the village head person or a senior individual's house, and they actually count the money in front of all the people. So again, they create a collective responsibility for making sure that there isn't corruption, because they're managing each other's money. And, you know, I was blown away. I was going, wow, this breaches every privacy rule that Australia talks about. But they're actually saying, account so-and-so, you know, Alan has this much money in their savings account and owes this much money for repayment of the loan. And the cash comes to the front and they count it in front and they stamp and people sign off in a community. So, you know, that's the type of thing. So it might not be corruption. I mean, ultimately, there's the insurance money should go somewhere, but interesting.
Yeah, no, and I mean, that was exactly how they told me the story, you know, what's happening. But the question is, you know, what, yeah, where the reserves are, what, it's just not clear. So, but I will take on board your comment about agent compensation. I remember trying to find out, and again, it wasn't clear. But that's a very good point. Okay. Households. This was insurance on the household. Okay, it was a household product. We distinguish between lapses between male and female. I believe it's because whoever was the owner of the policy. Okay, so if the owner of the policy was female, then that's counted as a female lapse. So, you know, that's sort of imperfect. But it is still interesting that there's a big difference in the story if you look at male and female lapses. What else should I talk about? The collector model. The collector model, so the agents, they went out to the villages. They essentially educated the villagers. This would often involve educating the headman or the village council, and the village council would then sort of convince or talk to the rest of the people in the village. So success really depended on getting the village elders on side. Okay, so, you know, if that worked, then, this, you know, you'd get people. And, you know, just as Alan said, community is very important, and community pressures were very important here, particularly with regard to the microcredit, the repayment of the loan side of things. As for insurance, I'm not really so sure, but it could well be. Yeah, actually, I mean, remember, this is life insurance and not health insurance, so that sort of community rating thing is not so applicable here. Yeah. All right, so what else can I talk about? Monthly lapse experience. I think it's a condition of the policy, so as long as they pay the first premium, it stays in force for a year. I'd have to look at the exact conditions, but I think that's why they do it. And maybe they have to... They can't have to pay a year's premium. That's ridiculous. But I've forgotten. So, but I think that was, maybe that's one of the conditions, is that they have to. And then, of course, there'd be a loss if they. Yeah, okay, that's a good question, Alan. I'll sort that out. Monthly lapse experience.
So I covered most of yours, Alan?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay. John, you're up.
Thanks. John Bayliss from State Civil. I have no expertise in this area. But a human interest, I guess, which comes through clearly, there is, by the sounds of it, a need for this stuff. So I'm interested in what you intend to do if you get this stuff sorted out. Are you going to reinvent this policy? And if so, how will you manage it differently? And clearly, this community aspect is the critical way to go for this particular environment. So I'm just interested in how you would kind of market it almost to meet that need.
Okay, thanks for that. That's a good question. So essentially, what we wanted to do here is, I mean, we've got this information, we've learned something, and then the question is, can we feed it back to the community? And the idea is, yes, we want to feed it back to the community. So the two ladies who helped me with this paper from the Philippines, Mia and Ivy, they're on staff at the University of the Philippines, and they teach actuarial mathematics there. Now, what we did, when we did all this, all our analysis was done using free tools, free software. Okay, so, I mean, the analysis was done in R, and you know, I've spared you all the equations, but, you know, we wrote out all the equations and everything like that. So, ultimately, the idea is that this paper is sort of a bit of a primer. So, an intelligent someone who's done maths at the university, could actually go away and work for some sort of community group, some sort of union, whatever, and actually apply this. So if their boss said, well, we'd like to start some sort of insurance scheme for our membership, you know, do we have any people who've done maths at uni? Well, there's lots of them, because lots of people do maths at the University of the Philippines. And, you know, there's a skill set here that, you know, this is a resource that they can use to actually start up a scheme like this.
Yeah. Okay, so there's a skill set in doing the maths, but there's not a skill set in understanding the business, which is where the money is and what's actually happening. So there's a kind of business element to teach as well alongside it.
And indeed, I mean, that's exactly what will be in the paper as well. There'll be a discussion of all these sorts of issues, and there'll be certainly a statement, you know, please contact your friendly member of the Filipino Actuarial Society. Okay, so I mean, you know, that'll be in there as well. But all those sorts of things. I mean, it's, you know, we want to feed back to the community what we've learned. You know, this is public domain stuff. They gave us the data. We want to share it, and hopefully this can be used in other ways.
Richard.
My name's Richard Lyon. I also know nothing about microinsurance, so therefore I'm going to speak. There's a mathematical issue, actuarial issue, there's a commercial issue, there's also a people issue. Because now we have communities in remote parts of the Philippines who have for a brief time had insurance, and now on the face of it they don't. And I wonder whether, in talking to these two people in their little room, you found out anything about whether that's actually the case, because my limited understanding is that in the easier-to-reach parts of the world, at least, where microinsurance and microfinance has penetrated, there's actually now quite strong competition. So you have this weird situation where at one point you're trying to help people who've got nothing, and the next point you're actually competing against somebody else who's managed to do this even more cheaply. So if these premiums are too high, have you in fact simply lost to other people coming in? Maybe even your agents, who are no longer with you, are now selling somebody else's product. I don't know if you know anything about that. If not, somebody needs to get in there and build on the work that's been done.
Okay, thank you, Richard. So, I mean, that's interesting in itself. So when we started this, we went to the insurance commissioner in Manila, and we got all the returns that we could to find out how much microinsurance business was being sold in the Philippines. And at that stage, there was relatively little business that was being sold. I went back last year, and we looked at the returns again. Just like you said, okay, I mean, people, insurance companies realize there's a market there. They're trying to get into it. So there are a lot more providers out there. Again, they're looking, I mean, you know, it's an archipelago. It's hard to reach. They're trying to get pick the low-hanging fruit. That's what they're trying to do, right? But, you know, there's a large unmet need. As you start moving outside the urban areas into the rural areas, that's a lot harder, and, you know, chances are these companies will only look at that some point in the future, not now. But, you know, this could be used. I mean, this sort of product is useful and it could be being used now.
Chris?
Okay, Chris Seddon. We'd be concerned about value for money here. Is the premium, you know, delivering value for money? But my question is perhaps what is the absolute level of the premium? I mean, were there various different sort of sums insured and premiums that people could choose here? And was the premium, in fact, perhaps too expensive? These people, you know, farmers and fishermen, they're subject to weather, and their incomes would be up and down. And, you know, are we perhaps in a situation where people could maintain an insurance, but if it were, you know, at a lower absolute level that they could, you know, cope with year after year potentially, and not sort of, you know, be able to afford it this year, and then next year there's a cyclone, there's no income, and not be able to afford it, you know, the next year.
Yeah, that's a great, a very insightful question, actually. To answer the first part of that, yes. So there was a menu, there was like a matrix. of lots of different things that were available in terms of the product offering. People made that choice, but I mean, you're exactly right. You know, they make the choice now for the here and now, but what happens in 3 months? What happens in 6 months? You know, when their rice crop fails, or you know, there's a you guys probably are aware of all the typhoons that go through. I lived through a typhoon in Manila. It was pretty scary. So I mean, the university shut down, all the trees outside my room fell over, the computer center got flooded, so I had no internet. I had no internet for days. So I mean, that's a good point, that the variability and how flexible it was. My understanding was the product was flexible, but it's been a long time since I've looked at the details, so I can't give you an exact answer to that. But yeah, that's an important issue, a very important issue. Thank you.
We're going to morning tea, so with your permission, we'll take one more question. Is
sure,
that okay?
Sure, sure.
So, Jan, you're up.
Yep.
Sorry, I'll be really quick, Jan, son. Because I've also worked in this market a little bit, and my understanding is manual life, you know, meaning, so we talked about two people shop here, but I think manual life has made quite a lot of inroads into that area. A couple of things that they've also identified as potential impediments, fraud. I think that's sort of kind of out there with the corruption. The other items that we looked at around the lapse was, you looked at some of the schemes in India or Pakistan. Government's kind of gone, that community, we're going to subsidize this, you know. So government keeps the lapses low. Often tax incentives, so coming back to Alan's point on Takaful, so I think they get tax deductibility to go under that Takaful model. And also there's an element of profit sharing at the end of the policy. So they have this risk fund, which is essentially your underwriting results up or down, and that gets shared, but at the end of the policy term. So meaning if it's 10, 15 years later, and you think in your community, think everybody's fairly healthy because you see them day to day, they do tend to keep that policy. And then often that Wakala model is what I'm talking about. They get 100% of that risk fund surplus back. So can't use profit in Takaful, but surplus, same thing. Yeah.
Yep.
So that's sort of that lapse thing that, you know, given we've worked in that market. Yep.
Great. Okay. That's it. So in fact, Mia's sister is the chief actuary at Manulife in the Philippines. So that's, yeah. So the issue of fraud, that was interesting. So that was one thing we really wanted to find out here. And we went through all the records. And in fact, that was one thing. Those two people in the office, one of them, the guy, he would go out, whenever there was a mortality claim, he'd go out and investigate. Okay. And the thing that he was worried about, once there were three deaths in one village in one day. So he thought, this is fraud. So he went out and, you know, let's, you know, because there'd been no instance of fraud before, went out and had a look. What had happened? There was an election. The mayor and his two bodyguards were shot. Okay, welcome to the Philippines.
Let's.
There's a minimum life warranty. Three might work, so as long as they're not married to each other.
Yes. You can be sure of that in the Philippines.
And that would be illegal, and the policy would pay out. You can't
pay out. Sati, final remarks?
Thank you.
So thank you from me as well for joining. Fascinating conversation. It is morning tea, so by all means stay for a chat if you wish. Otherwise, coffee time. Please join me in thanking Saatchi for, as he said, sharing his toys.